Our service is a series of events, as you might be curious about some of these symbols, what they mean, what holidays they represent. So we will build a little altar with a symbol of the season. We'll learn a little bit about that. We'll sing a song, and then we'll move on to the next holiday, if you will.
Do you have something to tell us about Advent? All right.
During the 4 weeks before Christmas, Christians prepare for the birth of Jesus.
This time is thus called Advent.
Thank you. And give it to me.
This year, the first Sunday of Advent was November 28th.
Today is the third Sunday. Today is the third Sunday of Advent, so if each one of you would light a candle. We're going to light the pink one for Gaudete Sunday, which means rejoicing. And then pass it on. And then if you want to write that one. Thank you very much for telling us a little bit about Advent. And now I'm going to tell us a little bit more. So if you want to go join your moms and dads, thank you very much. The Advent wreath is part of a long-standing Catholic tradition. However, the actual origins are uncertain. There is evidence of pre-Christian Germanic peoples using wreaths with lit candles during the cold and dark December days as a sign of hope in the future warm and extended sunlit days of spring. In Scandinavia during winter, lighted candles were placed around a wheel and prayers were offered to the God of Light to turn the wheel of the earth back toward the sun to lengthen the days and restore warmth. By the Middle Ages, Christians adapted this tradition and used Advent wreaths as part of their spiritual preparation for Christmas, expressing their belief that Christ, as it says in the Gospel of John, is the light that came into the world to dispel the darkness of sin and to radiate the truth and love of God. In 1600, both Catholics and Lutherans had more formal practices surrounding the Advent wreath. What does the Advent wreath symbolize? The wreath is made of various evergreens, signifying continuous life. The circle of the wreath symbolizes the eternity of the divine, the immortality of the soul, and the everlasting life found in Christ. The four candles represent the 4 weeks of Advent during which the faithful prepare for the arrival of Jesus. These candles are purple and one is rose or pink. The purple candles in particular symbolize the prayer and good works and penance undertaken at this time. The rose candle, as we lit today, is on the third Sunday, Gaudete or Rejoicing Sunday, because the faithful have arrived at the midpoint of Advent, when their preparation is now half over, and they are close to Christmas. The progressive lighting of the candles symbolizes the expectation and hope surrounding Jesus' first coming into the world and the anticipation of his second coming according to the scriptures. The light again signifies Christ, the light of the world. Some modern-day adaptations include a white candle placed in the middle of the wreath, which represents Christ and is lit on Christmas Eve. Current Advent celebration, by emphasizing the preparation for the Nativity, has made this a more family-oriented church season, and especially more child-friendly. I'm just curious, did any of you celebrate an Advent wreath in any time in your life? Aha! Oh, there's some Advent wreath lighters here. Great! Then you probably will recognize this. We did in my family. I grew up Roman Catholic. And this was the order. The first week of Advent, the youngest child lit the candle, and it was always a big deal. The second week, the oldest child lit the candle. And since I was the oldest, I was always game for that. The third week, the mother lit the candle, and the fourth week, the father lit all of the candles. And then we got really excited because we knew Christmas was very close at hand. So that's a little bit of the tradition of the Advent wreath and its history and meaning. Thank you.
The next holiday, which is Hanukkah. Now we'll light the candles of the menorah, and we'll say the blessing.
Baruch atah Adonai, Eloheinu melech haolam, asher kiddushanu b'mitzvah taf
Vitzivanu, Lahadlik Ner, Shel Hanukkah.
Do you want to say the traditional English translation?
Sure. Traditionally, it's Blessed art thou, Lord our God, King of the universe, who has commanded us to kindle the Hanukkah lights. Shalom. So remember last week we lit 5 candles for Hanukkah because we're on the 5th day of Hanukkah. We heard the story of Hanukkah, and Hanukkah ended on Wednesday night this year. So the 8-day holiday of Hanukkah doesn't always happen on the same days. It can be any time between the middle of November and the beginning of January. Now the dates move around because Hanukkah is set according to the Jewish calendar, which is based on the moon. So the holiday of Hanukkah begins on the 25th day of the Jewish month of Kislev. And by the way, this is the this is year 5771 in the Jewish calendar. So they've been keeping it for quite a while. Hanukkah begins 4 days before the new moon, which is the darkest night of the month. The new moon is the opposite of the full moon. It's when we don't see any light from the moon in the sky. So this time of year, the nights are very long. And this new moon night of Hanukkah falls closest to the longest night of the year. So this night in the middle of Hanukkah is the night during the year when we have the deepest darkness for the longest time. Hanukkah, the festival of lights, brings light to this deep, dark time, reminding us of hope. Shalom.
Thank you. Thank you. So this might be one of those holidays that you're not so familiar with. Bodhi Day. This is a holiday celebrated by Zen Buddhists. In Japan, they call it Rohatsu, which means the 8th day of the 12th month. And this happened on December 8th this year. It's the celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment. And so you'll see that there's a candle here, which is traditionally lit to indicate that enlightenment. Also in families, they might have bright, different colored lights on a tree, because this celebrates the day that the Buddha sat beneath the Bodhi tree and achieved enlightenment. And the different colored lights show that there are various paths to enlightenment. So we're going to hear the story of the Buddha, of how a young prince became known as the Buddha, or the Awakened One. So this young prince was born over 2,500 years ago, and he was named Siddhartha, which means the one who brings good. And of course, it was very joyful news that the king and the queen had a baby. This meant that there was a prince. And so many important people came to visit, and one of them was a sage named Asita. And when Asita met the eyes of this baby, tears came to his eyes. And the queen, the baby's mother, was very worried. Why is this wise sage crying about my baby? But the sage said that he was crying because he knew how special this baby was. And he knew that he had been waiting for the kind of wisdom that this child would bring into the world all his life, and that he would not live long enough to hear that wisdom. And he told them, he said, this baby will be either a king or a saint. And the king, the baby's father, thought, I know which way I want this to go. I want him to be a king. And so he set out to teach this child so many things, and the child was so wise and so bright that soon he surpassed his teachers. And he came just to teach himself by studying nature. But his father, the king, kind of kept him inside this beautiful castle, but behind walls. So he lived in this world that seemed perfect. He had everything he needed. There were servants to cater to his every need. Everything was beautiful and wonderful. And he thought, of course, this was how it was for everyone. Except that occasionally he heard the servants talking about other ways, other places, and he wanted to see them. So the king said, okay, 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 and told everyone, okay, everyone, you must look beautiful, you must be happy, you must lie in the streets and be colorful and lovely. And so then Siddhartha went out and saw how everything was beautiful, except that he saw one very old man who was so old he could barely walk. And so in this way he learned about old age. He went out one more time and the king said, okay, everybody, get ready, make it all look great. But Siddhartha saw someone who was very sick and weak and not doing well at all. The next time he went out, he actually saw someone who had died, who was in a coffin preparing for the final funeral rites. And in this way, he learned that there were such things as old age, sickness, and death. And he pondered and wondered about this and wondered, how can people live with this knowledge? And then he discovered and saw someone who was very thin, wearing a very simple robe, someone called an ascetic, who lived a life barely eating anything, barely drinking anything, living in the woods and trying to achieve enlightenment by just getting rid of all things attached to the world. And he thought, that is what I want to do. I want to really understand. And so he left the beautiful palace. He snuck away and spent 6 years living in the forest, eating almost nothing, meditating and trying to understand the nature of reality. And he discovered that he did not. He just discovered that he was very hungry and very weak. And so when some girl actually brought him some food, some rice, he took it. And he felt nourished by it and realized that it didn't make sense to be so completely detached from the world, that of course we are of the world. And so with this nourishment, he decided that what he wanted to do was really discover what was the nature of reality. And so he went to sit beneath a specific tree, the Bodhi tree. He sat beneath it in meditation and he said, I will not get up until I have achieved enlightenment, until I understand the nature of the world. And this was not an easy thing to do. The story tells us that there is a goddess named Mara who does not want people to achieve enlightenment. And so she brought all kinds of visions to Siddhartha. He imagined things that were enticing him away from his rest. There were things that looked very dangerous, like warriors coming at him. But he stayed still. And when he needed to, he touched the earth to ground himself. And he sat this way, some say for 40 days, some say for 6 days, some say for 1 day. It was a long time, however long it was. And in the morning, one morning, after however many days, there's the planet Venus, which rises and looks like a star, even though it's a planet. And when he saw that planet, that was when he achieved enlightenment. He viewed that star and he said, that's it. That's it. That's me. That's me that's shining so brilliantly. How marvelous. I, the great earth, and all beings are naturally and simultaneously awakened. He awoke and saw the nature of reality. He saw that we suffer when we're attached to things being a certain way. And he saw that the path of meditation was a way out of that suffering. And he spent the rest of his life teaching people what he had learned when he sat under the Bodhi tree. And that is what we celebrate on Bodhi Day, is both his enlightenment and the fact that he dedicated his life to teaching the rest of humanity what he had learned. And so that we today can still learn about the wisdom of Buddhism because of what he did under that Bodhi tree.
Today is the feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, so I'd like to invite my Guadalupe altar assistants to come forward, Liam and Bryce and Willow, and we'll create an altar for Our Lady of Guadalupe. And then we'll hear about her story. Our Lady of Guadalupe is considered the patroness not only of Mexico, but of the entire continental Americas. During this weekend, yesterday and today, over 6 million people will visit the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City. It is an amazing experience. You can Google processions of Guadalupe on your website and just see the beauty of this and the numbers of people that are involved in this. The Virgin of Guadalupe is the common denominator of Mexico, which, as you're probably aware, is a very, very diverse country. And this gives her people a sense of nationalism and patriotism. This unity comes from the strength of intense faith that is rooted in indigenous attributes, images, symbols, and mythology. The focus of this intense faith revolves around Our Lady, La Virgen María de Guadalupe, the Mother of God, who appeared in Mexico in 1531. And this is her story and the story of her visit. After 10 years of oppression by the Spaniards, followed by the Spanish conquest in 1519 to 1521, the native Nahua peoples had been very worn down. Their spirit was broken, but relatively few had been baptized as Christians. Even those who had been converted to Catholicism missed the closeness of worshiping their own gods and goddesses. They were separated from the deities that belonged to them, that looked like them. They felt orphaned by these deities and then adopted into a religion where they didn't really feel they belonged. When the Virgin Mary of Guadalupe appeared, brown-skinned and speaking a local language, they again had an object of worship that was their very own. The object of their worship, however, was ambiguous as they continued to address the Virgin Mary as Tonatzin, which was the name of the Mother Earth from their own indigenous practice. She was a shield of the weak, helper of the oppressed, and the mother of orphans. This is the story of her appearance to Juan Diego, according to accounts published in the 1640s. During a walk from his home village to Mexico City early on the morning of December 8, 1531, which in the Catholic feast days was the Feast of the Immaculate Conception, a 55-year-old widower and Nahua peasant, Juan Diego, saw a vision of a young girl of 15 or 16, surrounded by light, on the slopes of the hill of Tepeyac. Speaking in the local language, Nahuatl, the lady asked for a church to be built at that site in her honor, and from her words, Juan Diego recognized her as the Virgin Mary. So Diego told his story to the Spanish bishop, Juan de Zumárraga, who instructed him to return and ask the lady for a miraculous sign to prove her claim. Because after all, Juan Diego was simply a native peasant. What did he know? So come back at another time and give me more proof, said the bishop. The Virgin told Juan Diego to gather some flowers from the top of Tepeyac Hill. But remember, it was winter, and there were no flowers to be found on that hill. So Diego went, and he found flowers of every sort, and especially roses in winter. And the Virgin herself arranged them in his tilma, or peasant cloak, and she showed him how to tie them so they would not get lost on the way. And she said, "When you take this to the bishop, do not look inside. Simply carry this on the cloak, carry your cloak on your back, and when you get there, undo it, and let happen what will happen." So Juan Diego, of course, was very intrigued, and he opened the cloak before the bishop on December 12th. The flowers fell to the floor, and in their place was this image that you see in the statue of the Virgin of Guadalupe, miraculously, some say, imprinted on the fabric. That tilma cloak now stands in a glass case above the altar in the Basilica in Mexico City. Many scientific experiments have been done to test its validity, and to this day, none of the colors have faded. It is quite an amazing sight to see. So the appearance of Guadalupe on Tepeyac, the site of the destroyed Aztec temple of Tonatzin, the Mother Earth goddess, restored the dignity and spirit of these people. Her arrival is said to mark the birth of a new land and a new people, neither European nor pre-Hispanic, but now both, the first product, if you will, of the New World. Even her physical appearance announced the newness of this world. Her face looked neither like the Spanish nor the Nuaja. Her lovely features are the pleasant mixture of both. She is a mestiza, the first Mexican. The saintly brown-skinned image of Guadalupe appears on banners in all kinds of settings, on immigration rights marches. And just as one author says, when you think she's a liberal, she shows up at prayer vigils against abortion. Thousands have seen her also on the bass drum of Los Lobos, that amazing band from East L.A. She's everywhere, literally. She's everywhere. Guadalupe followed the Mexicans north as they settled the northern reaches of their country, areas that later became the United States. She remained at their side after the Mexican-American War, when they were strangers in a strange land. Today, 150 years later, she continues to accompany Mexicans as they cross the border. She remains the most powerful Chicana icon for Mexicans on the other side. Generations after the immigration of a family to the U.S., grandchildren and great-grandchildren treasure the presence of the Virgin and recognize her as mother of all Mexicans. And I think I'm missing a page.
Oh, no.
I will. Here we go. On the U.S. side, Guadalupe's values and strengths continue to inspire her children toward change, fulfillment, and honor. In the 1970s, United Farm Workers head Cesar Chavez carried the banner of Guadalupe in his relentless struggle for economic justice for migratory workers. Some of you may remember the pictures of those marches with the banner of Guadalupe held in front and carrying the roses and singing the songs. She was a powerful presence that inspired and sustained them all. Chavez and the UFW co-founder Dolores Huerta worked under the slogan, Si se puede, which means, yes, it can be done, and the patronage of the Virgin. As was, Huerta said, she is a symbol of faith, hope, and leadership. She has been incorporated into everything we do. Today, Mexican-American women and men in Mexico and the United States are seeing Our Lady of Guadalupe in a whole new light, invoking her to demand and expect more from themselves, their jobs, their homes, and their communities. As one woman said, the Virgin transcends all things. She is strength. She is beauty. She is wisdom and compassion. She is the symbol of ethnic identity, uniting people of different races, religions, and languages. She manifests, symbolizes, and activates the power of the people. She is a cultural symbol of justice, unconditional love, union, belonging, family, and home. If you are a young student in our Religious Explorations program, it's quite possible that so far this school year you haven't talked about Jesus in your classrooms. Maybe you've never heard the story of Jesus' birth or life ever before. So if you are a young student, I invite you to show me your eyes that see and your ears that hear. Christmas is the celebration of the birth of Jesus. Jesus of Nazareth was born long ago. He would come to be called Jesus Christ. As a young Jewish boy, Jesus was very special. He understood that he had a unique responsibility to teach the adults how to get along more cooperatively and how to treat each other with more peace and kindness and forgiveness. So in this way, Jesus was a teacher, a natural teacher. And from the time that he was very young, he would speak to whoever was willing to listen to him. Jesus also had an invisible gift of healing. Jesus was both a teacher and a healer, and he spent his time giving his gifts of teaching and healing to those who needed hope, forgiveness, to those who were sick, who were poor. As Jesus became a man, he became quite popular. He drew quite a following of people. The people loved him and were so touched by his giving that they called him a miracle worker and they called him the Son of God. There was a powerful ruler called Pontius Pilate who wasn't very fond of Jesus' rising popularity. He didn't want Jesus to become more popular and powerful, and he wanted Jesus to become silenced, and so he ordered Jesus' death. Jesus was killed when he was 33 years old.
And while that might seem pretty old to you, actually Jesus was younger than me when he was killed. In my opinion, that's a pretty short lifetime. But he made such an impact. His life was so important that a whole religion was created after his death called Christianity. And here we are, 2,010 years later, remembering how one person's life can change the world, can change human history because he had the courage to raise his voice and to speak his truth. And Christ's spirit can still be felt today. And to me, it feels safe and loving and kind. And it is a light in the darkness for millions and millions of people who celebrate Christ's birth and Christ's life at Christmas time.
You might wonder why we celebrate Christmas at this time of year. Well, there really wasn't a birth certificate for Jesus, but there were other festivals that were happening at that same time in that part of the world. Some that celebrated the sun coming out of the darkness. And the early Christians thought, this is our sun. Jesus is the light and the Son of God. And we want to take this time when other people are celebrating to celebrate the birthday of Jesus. And so there were many stories that grew up about where he was born. And one of those stories was that his parents traveled a long, long way and couldn't find a place to stay. And they had to stay in an old barn, a manger. And so people began to recreate that tradition by setting up a scene where shepherds who came and the mother, Virgin Mary, and Joseph basically gathered around in that humble beginning to welcome their son, the light of the world. And that's what we continue to do to this very day. Marla, thank you. And that leads us into our final celebration today, which is that of Kwanzaa. So I'd like to invite all of those children and youth who are helping with creating the Kwanzaa altar to please come forward. Lucy, Emma Rose, Liam, Brandon, Bryce, Sonora, Isla, Willow, and Yael. We'd like to tell you a little bit about Kwanzaa, and then our students are going to light the 7 candles for Kwanzaa, and they'll tell you about what those principles mean. Kwanzaa is a 7-day African-American and Pan-African holiday which celebrates faith, family, community, and culture. It's celebrated from December 26th through January 1st, and its origins are in the first harvest celebrations of Africa, from which it takes its name. The name Kwanzaa is derived from the phrase Matunda wa Kwanzaa, which means first fruits in Swahili, a Pan-African language which is the most widely spoken African language. So this festival draws on all of those traditions.
Rooted in this ancient history and culture, Kwanzaa developed as a flourishing branch of the African-American life and struggle as a recreated and expanded ancient tradition.
Kwanzaa was actually established in 1966 in the midst of the Black Freedom Movement by Dr. Mwalangwa Karenga, professor of Africana Studies at California State University, Long Beach, who stressed the indispensable need to preserve, continually revitalize, and promote African-American culture. Thus, it reflects concern for cultural groundedness in thought and practice and the unity and self-determination associated with this.
Finally, Kwanzaa is a cultural holiday, not a religious one, thus available to and practiced by Africans of all religious faiths who come together based on the rich, ancient, and varied common ground of their Africanness. During Kwanzaa, a 7-branched candelabra called a kinara holds 3 red, 3 green, and 1 black candle. Black for the people, red for their struggle, and green for the future and hope that comes from their struggle. Kwanzaa has seven principles that correspond with 7 days of the celebration. Each day represents a value that must be celebrated year-round. This morning, our religious explorers will speak these principles as they light the candles.
First principle about unity. To strive for and maintain unity in the family, community, nation, and race.
And Isla, would you light the first candle, our black candle, for us, please?
The second principle, self-determination.
To define ourselves, name ourselves, create for ourselves, and speak for ourselves.
And would you light one of the green candles, please, Brandon?
Third principle, collective work and responsibility. To build and maintain our community together and make our brothers' and sisters' problems our problems and to solve them together.
Fourth principle, cooperative economics. To build and maintain our own stores, shops, and other businesses and to profit from them together.
Fifth principle, purpose. To make our collective vacation the building and developing of our communities in order to restore our people to their traditional greatness.
Willow, would you like the second red candle?
Sixth principle, creativity. To do always as much as we can in the way we can in order to leave the community more beautiful and beneficial than we inherited it.
And Bryce, would you light the last green candle, please?
Seventh principle, faith. To believe with all our heart that in our people, our parents, our teachers, our leaders, and the righteousness and victory of our struggle.
These values, these seven principles, which you may know some connection to and see some similarity to other seven principles, represent values that the community is encouraged to celebrate throughout the entire year. So I'd like to thank... Okay.
Thank you all. So it takes a long time to go through a month worth of holidays, and of course we didn't touch on all of them. For time, we're not going to sing hymn 147. As you might have sensed, there's a theme here. We can look and see candles shining for each of these holidays, although the Hanukkah candles have burned out at this point. So there are these themes of light in darkness. It is not coincidental that these holidays are celebrated during December, where we have these long, dark nights. So we see the candles of Advent lighting hope, lighting as we're waiting for someone to come, the bright, shining star that will announce the birth of Jesus in a time of darkness and oppression during a time of empire. So these candles of hope in the Advent candle. Similarly, candles of hope in the menorah for Hanukkah, candles celebrating people who cared enough about their faith to overcome great odds and retake the temple that was so important to them. We see the celebration of the Buddha and the enlightenment that he brought. Similarly, we heard about the enlightenment that Jesus brought with his birth and his teachings. Our Lady of Guadalupe, who serves as inspiration to so many people, serves as protector of all the people of the Americas. And the lights of Kwanzaa lifting up values that bring light to a certain culture. But there's one light up here that we haven't talked about. What's that one? The chalice. So our chalice, which is a container that can hold all of the values celebrated in each of these holidays. But of course, Christmas is especially relevant to us because we have a Judeo-Christian heritage from which we have evolved and grown. Yet we can also call on the wisdom of all of these other traditions. Our chalice is a large container. And that light of our chalice can serve as both a warm beacon of welcome, that this is a place to find kindred spirits, to find acceptance, to come and be known. But this is a safe place. The chalice was originally a symbol used during World War II by the Unitarian Service Committee, and it literally would be a symbol in a window beckoning safety, recognizing it was a safe house for people trying to escape the oppression of the Nazis, particularly children who were trying to leave Europe and be safe. And that flame of our chalice not only is a beacon of warmth and welcome and safety, but it also calls us. It shows us a vision of what is possible, and that light leads us on, that we do not just come here to be safe. This is not just an oasis or a sanctuary where we stay and disconnect from the rest of the world, but that chalice is our beacon that shows us that there is possibility beyond what we see now in our world. And that chalice calls us to act, calls us to discover that we are the light, that we are the star, and how do we bring our light into the world. So we are called to do that together. As we have seen these varied cultures, we will now hear a song, I Saw Three Ships. You'll see lots of cultures came to celebrate the birth of Jesus according to this song, and we will join in on the chorus, I think.